Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Farmer Talk Radio. I'm Valerie Bowling, producer and host of today's program, which is dedicated to the topic of immuno-oncology, exploring the challenges and potential. Pharma Talk Radio is a nonprofit program and aims to provide free and easy access to information helpful to those involved in drug development and getting therapeutics to patients faster. And we hope the program is also helpful to those who just have an interest in the life sciences. So immuno-oncology, or today's topic, is arguably one of the most exciting areas in the advancement of science and patient care today. However, with all research, there are plenty of challenges, and to get a better understanding of the reality of this innovative approach to cancer research, I'm pleased to welcome to the program Dr. James Gulley of the National Cancer Institute and Dr. Roy Baines, who joins us from Merck Research Labs. Also joining today's program is Kate Woda, director of the Immuno-Oncology 360 Conference, which is taking place at Columbia University in New York City on June 29th and 30th. So with that, if I may begin with Dr. Gulley. Well, welcome, Dr. Gulley.
Thank you very much, Valerie. Glad to be here.
I'm so pleased to have you. Can you tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to join the National Cancer Institute?
Sure. So I completed an MD-PhD program at Loma Linda University and did my internal medicine training at Emory University. Then I came here to the National Cancer Institute in 1998 as a medical oncology fellow. I decided that I really liked it here, and there was a lot of research going on in immunotherapy, which was I was very interested in and did my PhD work in. And so I stayed on as staff here at the National Cancer Institute.
Thank you. And so with that, can you tell us about some of the work the National Cancer Institute is doing to help advance our understanding of immuno-oncology?
Absolutely. So I'm delighted to represent a group of phenomenal investigators here at the National Cancer Institute that's really doing a lot, both understanding immunotherapy in the laboratory, as well as bringing this understanding into the clinic. There is work going on here in CAR T-cell therapy, adoptive cellular therapy with other T-cells, with therapeutic vaccines, and with immune checkpoint modulation. Most of my work has been with therapeutic vaccines and immune checkpoint modulation, which I think has been a really fun area of work for me, and there's a lot of potential there for combination.
Okay, I'm going to get back to that in a moment. I should have really started with the question of, you know, why has there been so much interest recently in immunotherapy?
That's a great question. So the interest in immunotherapy, I think, it stems in part from the fact that with immunotherapy, we are seeing very nice prolonged responses in patients. Patients who will have complete disappearance of their tumors for now long periods of time, in some cases out to 10 years now. And this is seen in a proportion of patients. And it's this difference that we're seeing compared with conventional therapy, where you can see nice shrinkage of disease, but inevitably the disease comes back. And so we're trying to figure out which patients are more likely to have these types of responses that are so encouraging, and also ways to get a larger proportion of the patients having these responses. I think this has really driven the interest in the whole field of immuno-oncology. And I would just add one thing, that the patients themselves like the idea that their body's immune system is helping fight the cancer. And that really has led to a great acceptance among patients for these types of therapies, which in general are pretty well tolerated, and there may be some side effects, but these are in general transient and manageable.
You know, you mentioned that you began, I believe you said 1998 at the NCI, and here we are in 2015. Can you shed some light on what you've seen since 1998 to now? Like, I can hear you sound very encouraged. What are the changes and developments you've seen over that period of time?
Great question again. So to put things in perspective, I think we've learned an awful lot about the immune system and about what is, perhaps more importantly, about what is going on with our immune therapies at the site of the tumor. So following an immune-based therapy, we had in the past been looking a lot at what goes on in the blood, and that's good, but if you're engineering something that you want to have activity at the tumor, you also need to look at the tumor. And so I think we've really learned a lot about interactions at the level of the tumor and the importance of that. And that has led us, into several different areas where we are now understanding immune checkpoint modulation is very important. And I can tell you, I just came back from the American Society for Clinical Oncology meetings in Chicago, and at those meetings there was a huge buzz about immunotherapy and a lot of these immune checkpoint modulating agents that are out there, including several that have been recently approved by the FDA. That's, I think, driving a lot of interest in the field and the potential. I think this has set a solid foundation now that we have immunotherapy, for instance, for lung cancer, that one of the biggest cancer that we have, the one that causes the most number of fatalities worldwide and in the U.S. And now we are seeing nice improvements in survival with limited side effects. But we're only seeing good responses in a proportion of patients. So I think this is the first step. And I think the next step is going to be, how do we increase the proportion of patients that are responding to this really breakthrough type of therapy?
Lovely. That sounds like a great next step for everybody. Dr. Baines, let me bring you into the conversation, and thank you, Dr. Gulley. I'd love to know a little bit about your background and how you came to join Merck Research Labs.
Sure. So I started off my career obtaining an MD and PhD in Johannesburg, South Africa. Moved to the U.S. in the late 80s and spent a number of years in academic medicine. Went to industry in the early 2000s at initially Amgen, subsequently Gilead Sciences, and then more recently at Merck Research Laboratories. I am a hematologist, oncologist, and bone marrow transplanter by training, and it's been a unique privilege and pleasure to participate in Merck's immuno-oncology program.
Thank you. I wanted to ask you more about that. Merck is helping lead the space, and can you tell us a little bit about that, about the work that Merck is doing in immunotherapy?
Sure. Well, I think as Dr. Gulley intimated, we've known for many years that the body does tend to have a system of immune surveillance such that when a mutation occurs in a cell which could cause that cell to become malignant, the body has a mechanism aimed at protecting and defending against that. That's largely the immune system. For a variety of reasons, however, malignancy is very smart and is able to evade this immune surveillance, and in part it does this by elaborating intermediates which interact with receptors on the very cells that should be killing the cancer to essentially turn them off and make them exhausted or essentially non-reactive to the malignancy. Now, the allure of revving up the immune system has been around for many years, and this has been explored by many different mechanisms. But more latterly, the notion that if we block the interaction between a receptor and the ligand that is or intermediate that is switching off the inflammatory or immune response, we can reveal that immune mechanism. That has been really at the fundamental basis of this immunotherapy revolution, if you will. And so the checkpoint inhibitors are a great example of molecules which typically switch off the immune response. If we can block that effect, we can, in many circumstances, reveal the immune mechanism. So at Merck, we have been working on a number of checkpoint inhibitors, but our lead molecule to mention is a PD-1 antibody, and this is a molecule known as pembrolizumab or Keytruda. Now, PD-1 is one of these receptors on the lymphocyte, which when it is engaged by the ligand, either PD-L1 or PD-L2, which is made in some measure by the cancer cell, that switches off the immune response. By using this antibody, we can block the receptor and prevent this interaction with this ligand, and that has the effect in a proportion of patients of turning on the immune response. So we have explored this molecule in its and its ability to affect the malignant process, and we've done this in a fairly broad and deep way. We have explored firstly across 30 different tumor types in now close to 100 studies involving some 16,000 patients, exactly which tumor types we are seeing responses in. And it's just been fascinating to watch the breadth of this activity come forward. So, for example, we see activity now in melanoma, non-small cell lung cancer, head and neck, bladder cancer, gastric cancer, classical Hodgkin's disease, triple negative breast cancer, mesothelioma, and then more recently at this ASCO meeting, we also presented data on activity in small cell lung cancer, esophageal cancer, ovarian cancer, renal cancer, and colorectal cancers that have a very specific gene marker. So that speaks to the breadth of what we're seeing, and we have many more tumor types being interrogated at the moment, and I suspect we will see a large number being added to this list. The program has also looked
Thank you for that update. I had a follow-up question for you, but continue, please.
No, that's fine. Just to say that we're also looking at the depth of activity, that is to say, exploring this antibody in salvage therapy and then in more early lines of treatment. And then I think, as Dr. Gulley mentioned, you know, it's a proportion of patients that do respond. We're trying to use markers to identify those patients who will respond and also to use markers to try and identify those patients who may need additional therapy, such as combination therapies.
I'm so pleased you mentioned that, because I was actually going to go back to that when Dr. Gulley mentioned it. Can you both tell us more about that, the combination therapies? There's a lot of talk around it. What does it really mean, and what is its potential promise? I open that to both of you.
So, well, I'll take a crack at it, and then Dr. Gulley can elaborate further.
Perfect.
You know, I think as we think about combinations, there are a number of possible ways that one could come at this. One could look at combinations of immunotherapy along with standard therapy such as radiation or chemotherapy. And the reason for doing that, you know, there could be many biologically plausible reasons, but one might be that you increase the number of mutations or abnormalities in DNA. That leads to increased number of abnormal proteins in the cancer cell, which may lead to increased number of what we call antigens. These are small segments of protein which are thought to excite the immune response. You could imagine combinations with standard targeted therapies and, you know, for similar types of reasons. You could consider combinations with other immunologic modifiers. So you could consider, for example, combining two checkpoint inhibitors together, or combining a checkpoint inhibitor together with a co-stimulatory molecule. This immune system has really two sides to the equation, if you will. You have the checkpoint inhibitors, which tend to dampen the immune response, and then you have co-stimulatory molecules, which tend to enhance the immune response. And then yet another set of combinations may relate to approaches aimed at increasing the overall, if you will, immunogenicity or antigenicity of the malignancy. And this could rely, for example, on such approaches as cancer vaccines or, for example, oncolytic viruses, which have the potential to both kill cancer cells as well as render increases in immunogenicity based upon their digestion by, for example, antigen-presenting cells. I'll turn it over to Dr. Gulley to comment further.
So thank you so much. I completely agree with what you said. I think what we have noticed in the lab is that some of these standard of care agents can change the way that the tumor actually looks to the immune system to make it easier for the immune system to recognize or kill the tumor, something we refer to as immunogenic modulation. So it can upregulate death receptors, upregulate the antigens. And so things like chemotherapy, radiation therapy, targeted small molecule therapy can do this. Another area that we've been intensely involved in recently is what we call immunogenic intensification, which is combining things that can cause further priming of the immune system along with the immune checkpoint inhibitors. So I think of the anti-PD-1 and anti-PD-L1antibodies like pembrolizumab. They really unlock or unblock the activity of the T cells within the tumor. So in patients that have T cells that are at the tumor ready to go, but they're just blocked from action by this negative checkpoint, these checkpoint inhibitors can result in phenomenal, rapid, and durable responses. But in patients without that underlying immune response, there's really much less activity. And so it's kind of like a campfire where if you have a smoldering immune response that you're trying to light with this wet wood or green wood, and you come in with the immune checkpoint inhibitor being like gasoline or something like that, a flammable liquid, that can really get that fire going, an accelerant. And in those patients that don't have the underlying smoldering immune response, you're basically just throwing this accelerant on dirt, and so there's no real reaction. So I think the potential is there to really accelerate the activity of immunotherapies by focusing on getting that underlying immune response within the tumor, and I think there's a variety of different ways that we're doing that. One way that we've done at the NCI is combining vaccines with immune checkpoint inhibitors, and we've published recently data on combination of our vaccine in prostate cancer along with ipilimumab, a different immune checkpoint inhibitor. But I think that there's also data that has come out with combinations of two different immune checkpoint inhibitors to also look at this immunogenic intensification. But I think that potentially combining these types of therapies can get that underlying immune response so that these immune checkpoint inhibitors can come in and further expand that and greatly increase the proportion of patients, hopefully, that will respond to this type of treatment.
Dr. Gulley, we can talk a little bit more about, it's currently not one approach for all, clearly. But with that, what are some of the shortfalls of this approach?
Yes, so good question. I think that one shortfall we kind of alluded to is the fact that only a minority of patients have an underlying immune response. And it may depend on different cancer types. I think what many have been looking at when they're trying to understand who might benefit from these types of treatment approaches with PD-1 or PD-L1 inhibitors is looking at the expression within the tumor microenvironment of PD-L1. This is the signal that can shut down a T cell and basically tell it not to work. It's a stop sign for the T cell, which is the one of the main ways we kill cancer cells is with T cells. And so if you have that underlying stop sign there, coming in with a antibody that can block that stop sign and allow that T cell to go ahead and do its work will be effective. If you don't have that underlying stop sign there, or you don't have an underlying activated and immune response, you're less likely to get this to work. So that right now, I think, is what we're looking at. What do we do for those patients that don't have the underlying immune response, and how do we generate that?
Okay. For people who have been, a fairly successful response. You mentioned earlier that there's few side effects, and I wanted to know what are they, if any. What, you know, patients who may have this as an option to them, what might be some of the side effects they should be aware of?
That's a great question. So the types of side effects that we're seeing with these immune checkpoint inhibitors vary depending on what type of immune checkpoint inhibitor is given and if it's in combination with something else. But in general, the side effects seen with anti-PD-1 or anti-PD-L1 are relatively mild and can include fatigue, can include some flu-like symptoms, some fever, etc. And there can be, in some cases, what we call immune-related adverse events that may be targeted at certain organs. So maybe your liver enzymes will increase, which can be measured in the blood, or maybe the thyroid gland or some other glands would come under attack. And basically what we can do is we can easily measure for that, we can easily monitor for that, and we can easily intervene by either discontinuing agent and or starting something to suppress the immune response, which usually still allows for continuation of the underlying immune response against the tumor, but can quiet down the immune response against normal tissue. And
okay.
Furthermore, I would
Thank
just
you.
Say that with things like your thyroid, you can, if that's damaged to some part, to some extent, there are agents that we can use, like Synthroid, that can be used to replace the hormone normally made by the thyroid.
Okay, thank you. I wanted to share a little story. We have been talking with patients who've gone through the process. And one of the patients, a woman named Jamie Goldfarb, who's actually going to be speaking at Kate's conference as a patient advocate, she was diagnosed with late-stage melanoma and had just had an infant, a baby boy, and was told she had 6 months to live and they're going to do everything they can to get her 6 months with this baby. And she didn't accept that as an option, and she did her research and found out about a clinical trial through the National Cancer Institute and got in the trial and did very well through immuno-oncology, and she is doing extremely well today. And the reason why she wanted to speak at our conference so badly was that she was not given a clinical trial as an option and had to do research independently to find one, and in her case it worked brilliantly for her. And so I wanted to open this question up to both of you. Where can patients go to find out about clinical trials, or how do they get access to immuno-oncology? Maybe that's the bigger question to ask. How do patients get access to this advanced therapy? Dr. Baines, do you have any thoughts on that?
So there are a number of resources to consider. Firstly, in any given disease type, fairly often there are support related to the disease type, and very often they're a good resource for pointing towards clinical trial activity. There's a listing of studies at clinicaltrials.gov, which is a very comprehensive listing, all of the registered clinical trials. Oftentimes you can get an idea of where they're being conducted. Are they at sites near to where one might live? Very often one's own physician or cancer center or wherever one's getting care can be a very good resource, either in terms of pointing in the direction of clinical trials or alternatively actually offering clinical trials. I think that one would encourage patients to ask their physician, treating physician, about whether they're a candidate for a clinical trial. And frankly, if one is not necessarily hearing what one wants to hear, there's really no harm in seeking an additional opinion.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Gully, is there anything else you'd like to add to that?
I think that I would just second exactly what Dr. Bain said. I would also add that you can also find trials on cancer.gov and look for the clinical trials there. It also has a lot of useful information for patients if they want to understand what terms are and what the different phase of clinical trials are, et cetera.
Okay, thank you. I'd love to talk a little bit more about clinical trials and, you know, if a patient enters a trial, you know, what can they expect? Dr. Baines, can I start with you on that question? So if a patient indeed does enter a trial, what can they expect generally?
Well, the clinical trial process generally involves, firstly, a dialogue around what the object of the trial is, what the eligibility criteria are, what the operational details of the trial are. Very often there's a need for, you know, close monitoring and for fairly regular imaging to gauge the response or progression of the disease. There's oftentimes need for laboratory surveillance to look for some of the side effects that Dr. Gully mentioned. And oftentimes the trials are controlled trials. They may be comparative trials where one's comparing one treatment with another treatment. And so patients need to have a very fulsome discussion about what that all entails. I think that the harsh reality is that still a minority of patients do participate in clinical trials. And I think it would just be very helpful to recognize that, in fact, clinical trials are a very good form of treatment in that you're getting state-of-the-art treatment, getting close surveillance, and you're actually very close to, you know, the evolving data as they emerge. So, you know, a lot to recommend the participation in these.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Gully, where are the trials being held? Are they all over the country? Are they at major centers? Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Sure. So I'd also like to add a little bit on to what Dr. Bain said, because I completely agree that there are a few number of patients going into clinical trials, and in adult oncology, it's less than 5%. Compared with in pediatric oncology, it's more like 80%. So I think, you know, we have a ways to go. The trials are being done in community centers. They're being done at major institutions. There are a variety of different settings where you can find these clinical trials, major teaching hospitals, as well as your community oncologist. I would also like to point out that there are different types of trials. So I think it's important when you're looking up these trials on the web, and when you come up and you say, okay, what's the difference between phase one, phase two, phase three? So a phase one clinical trial is typically a trial that is the first time that agent or that combination is being tested in humans. And the goal typically of a phase one study is to determine the safety of that agent. And typically we start with low doses of the drug and then go up. A phase two study is often a single arm, but it can be a two-arm study looking at the preliminary evidence that drug has activity. Sometimes we'll be looking at, does it shrink the tumor or does it delay the time until one progresses, compared either to what we would predict for that given disease or compared to another agent. And then a phase three study is really the study designed to prove the safety and efficacy of a drug in a given indication, usually a very select group of patients, and usually the comparator arm is a standard of care, and then the experimental arm, if you will, is the new drug, either alone or in combination with standard of care.
Okay, thank you. I'd like to ask you, Dr. Gulley, if you can summarize for us, what's the next big steps for us to advance immuno-oncology?
So I really think that we are we have already stepped onto the edge of something really, really big here. I think that we have the first big series. And you heard, as Dr. Baines mentioned, these agents are showing activity in a wide range of different cancers. I think the next big step is, how do we increase the proportion of patients that are responding? How do we combine these agents in a way that we're going to lead to an improved proportion of patients getting this nice, beautiful, durable responses? In fact, many people are referring to these responses that we're seeing, where you're eradicating diseases, as functional cures, much like what we call in the HIV realm, patients that don't have any evidence of disease for a prolonged period of time. And I think if we can get a higher proportion of patients, if we can move this from, in some cases, 20% of the patients having a nice response to 40% to 60% or more, I think that is going to be the next step that we want to take here.
How much would it help if we could go from 5% of patients in clinical trials to even 10%?
I think we would get the answers much more quickly. I think we would be able to turn around and use the answers that we get to treat many more patients. Because remember, every patient that goes into a clinical trial, that data is captured, and that can be used to help understand the disease, help treat patients from that generation on. So it's more than just potentially helping that one patient. It's really changing the field, and I think that we're right now on the verge of really making even bigger breakthroughs, and I think now is a great time to get into clinical trials.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Baines, I wanted to ask you to summarize what you're excited about, and if there's any other steps, next steps that you wanted to add.
Well, I think you've heard probably from Dr. Gulley and myself the sense of great excitement, at the notion that, in fact, we can unlock the body's innate immune system to really, do what it was meant to do, and that is to eradicate invading pathogens as well as malignancy. And certainly it appears that in a proportion of patients, we are making tremendous progress in this regard. I think the really exciting part for me has been the depth of the responses, the duration of the responses, and the breadth of the responses. I think the use of selection criteria, using biomarkers to try and identify patients who are most likely to respond, is proving to be quite valuable. And in fact, in some of the tumor types, for example, our experience in lung cancer, using a PD-L1 marker in the tumor, we're able to have response rates go up to close to 1 in 2 patients, which is really quite remarkable. I think the early experiences with some of the combination approaches is looking very promising, and I think to the extent that we can select patients who are going to benefit most from combinations and rapidly study those, I think will be a great service to the cancer patient. So, again, the sense of excitement, if you have attended any of the recent cancer meetings, is palpable. Routinely the immuno-oncology sessions, even in the largest plenary halls, are overflowing. There's a genuine sense that we're on really involved in something very important here, and there's a terrific sense of excitement around that.
Thank you. Kate, let me bring you into the conversation a bit as we're wrapping up. You are the director of the Immuno-Oncology 360 event, and so I know this program's coming up at the end of June 29th, 30th, at Columbia University in New York City. Can you tell us just very briefly what you hope this conference can do to help the industry?
Sure, absolutely. The Immuno-Oncology 360 program really takes a look at the immuno-oncology investment landscape and the deals and how to go from that into clinical trials and really focusing in and emphasizing on optimizing clinical strategies for cancer immunotherapy. And what we hope to do is to really share as many strategies and best practices in this developing space.
Okay. Can you tell us a little bit about the speaking faculty?
Absolutely. We're delighted to have on the program Dr. Gulley and Dr. Baines, who are participants today on today's show. We also have additional keynotes, including Dr. Drew Pardoll from Johns Hopkins University and Dr. Axel Hoos from GlaxoSmithKline, just to name a few. And we also have representation from the investment community, major cancer hospital centers, large pharma, biotech, along with the academia and research organizations, to really bring together a 360-degree discussion on cancer immunotherapy.
And you have patients as well, so that'll really make it 360. So terrific. If listeners want more details about the program, where can they go?
So they can visit the website at theconferenceforum.org and select Immuno-Oncology 360 from the conference drop-down menu. And there you'll be able to access the program agenda, a full list of the speaker faculty, along with any additional program logistics. And we're also very active on social media. So we have set up a Twitter handle, hashtag IO360NYC. And you can join our LinkedIn group, Immuno-Oncology 360, where we regularly have updates on the program.
Okay. Kate, thank you very much. This is indeed arguably one of the most exciting areas of science and patient care, and it's been such a pleasure to speak with all of you about the advancements. I realize the realities are it's not working on everybody, but it just seems that there's a massive effort to figure out why and how can we have this therapy work on as many people as possible. So hugely exciting. I want to thank you, Dr. Gulley and Dr. Baines for joining me today. And Kate, best wishes with the IO360 conference. And thank you, everyone, again.
Thank you, Valerie.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.